Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being with us once again on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call as we talk today about the real estate market. Our guest, Matt Hodges, he's a Charlottesville branch manager for Presidential Bank Mortgage, and Jim Duncan, broker and partner at Charlottesville's Nest Realty. Good morning, General.
Hey, Rick. Morning.
Thanks for joining us again today. So I'm curious, as someone who is not looking for homes, although my wife regularly sends me imagery for checking out this home and that home, what is going on with the current market? Should I be looking for a home? Should I be happy that I'm not looking to buy a home?
Yes. I think, as you know, Rick, and thanks for having us back, my answer to almost everything is it depends. You know, the Charlottesville area market right now is, to put a pin in it, the strongest seller's market I've seen in 20 years. The buyer activity with, you know, this is a broad brush, and the buyer activity that we're seeing right now in our market is, through my lens, unprecedented. You know, we're seeing offers, you know, 5, 6, 10, even 18 or 20 offers on properties. And these are predominantly in the city of Charlottesville and, you know, the county of Albemarle. But I ran into an agent the other day who said that she went to a house to show it in Greene County, and there were 20 people in line to get in. So it is ridiculous right now. I think with any market, pricing is key, but in some aspects, pricing is almost irrelevant. You know, comps, the sold comps that we're seeing are not reflective of the pending prices that we're seeing in the Charlottesville area. So I think it is an extraordinary seller's market. And I think on the flip side, from a buyer's perspective, if you're buying, and I've said this for a long time, if you're buying for a longer horizon, 5, 7, 10, 12 years, as most of my buyers are, I think that you should be, you know, candidly, I do a lot of work with buyers, somewhat intimidated, but also mindful of the fact that projection for population growth in our area is significant. You know, supply and demand is a real thing. You know, Albemarle County grew nearly 12% in the last 10 years. The city of Charlottesville grew about 14%. And Greene County grew 10%. So, I mean, I think that we're seeing an influx of people that, you know, as long as there are more buyers than there are sellers right now, it's an exceptional market for people who are looking to sell, and it could be a good market for those looking to buy for the long term.
Well, is it possible to put an average home price these days? Is that a phrase you can use, the average home price?
No. I mean, I think that it's it really does. That really does depend on the market segment. I mean, a 3-bedroom, 1.5 bath in the city of Charlottesville could be $400,000, and then go to Flavanna. You know, I showed one the other day. It was like, I think it was 3 beds, 2 baths, with the full finished basement on a couple acres for nearly $400,000. And a condo in the city of Charlottesville can be, you know, $400,000 to $600,000 at least. So there's no such thing as an average price. It really is depending on your micro market and where you fall within that market range.
Are we driving out large groups of current residents, people who grew up here, for example?
I mean, I think the people who grew up here. In some regards. I mean, I was talking to a former client of mine on Twitter today, actually. And she was reflecting how in her market, somewhere else, the place where they bought 5 years ago, they couldn't afford today. So I think that people who grew up in Charlottesville, you know, your first-time home buyer starting out, you know, 25, 28 years old, unless you have an exceptional job and income, and candidly, parents helping you out is often the case. It's a challenging market. So I think what we're seeing now is that we're seeing people are being driven, figuratively and literally, to the outer counties, Fluvanna, Green, Louisa, even Nelson, to find a home that is is desirable and suitable for what they're looking for.
We are talking about the real estate market in our area. Jim Duncan, he's a broker and a partner with Charlotte Hills Nest Realty. We also have Matt Hodges with us today. Matt is with Presidential Bank Mortgage. Matt, we were talking about how strong the market is. And Jim mentioned going to a showing, or a friend talking about a showing in Greene County where there were already 20 people in line. What are the good and bad decisions in a thought process in order to be the number one selection in buying this house? If the seller has a long list, has 20 offers on the table, is it more to it than just being the highest offer? What do you do? I would think that you can try and offer more than other people. What are the good and bad choices and decisions to put out there?
Sure. So I don't get involved too much in that contract offer, but I add value to the discussion. So there might be a discussion with a property that comes onto the market in the city, and we know that there's going to be multiple offers. And so the discussion point between me and the realtor and the potential purchaser is, okay, what number are we going to look at to make an offer? And then what's the escalation clause? So that's an additional amount that the buyer is willing to pay over the next highest bid in certain amount of increment dollars above it. And so that's one of the things that we have a discussion about. And just anecdotally, I've been involved in numerous of those situations where you have 6, 8, 10 different buyers. And in some cases, you're issuing multiple pre-qualifications for two different clients, two different realtors. Nobody knows that because you can't tell each of the parties, but that happens sometimes. So it's really just giving the client that you've got in front of you the best advice along with their realtor on what is going to look attractive. And most importantly, it fits their financial goals. We don't want them to bid over asking price simply to win the deal. It has to feel right to them. It has to fit their budget, not what I can approve them for, what they feel comfortable writing a check for each month.
Yeah, and Rick, I think that, Rick, real quick, when I'm helping buyers put together the right offer for them, I'm going to answer this two ways, from buyer and seller. From a buyer's perspective, it has to be an offer they're comfortable winning or losing. If the asking price is 400 and they go in at 400 with an escalation to 460, which would be crazy, but maybe not, they'd have to be comfortable if they won, if you will. And if they're asking 400 and they make an offer of 395 going to 405 and they lose, okay. The value is what you're willing to pay. And I try to encourage my buyers to not make an offer to beat the other people, but make an offer that you're comfortable winning or losing. And from seller's perspective, I wrote a story years ago that talks about how it's more than price. And in this current market, sometimes if the buyer is offering cash, that's certainly appealing because most often appraisal is not an issue because the buyers are not getting an appraisal. But it's also, you're looking at the closing date. Whether that buyer of your house is making an offer that's contingent on the sale of their house. What's the closing date? What's the financing date? Who's the lender? To Matt, adding value, having a local lender such as Matt makes an enormous value because you feel, I instill confidence in my clients that Matt will bring value and he'll actually be able to close versus some of the unnamed lenders that who may or may not be able to. So it's not always about price. It's a huge factor, but I had clients the other day lost out. They were a higher value or higher price, but some components of the offer were such that the seller chose a different offer that was a little bit lower. So it really does depend on each scenario as to what makes the best offer, if you will.
So without getting into, I don't want to turn this into a sales pitch for who Matt works for, but how does a local lender bring value into my search for a house or my sale of my house?
Okay, so just from my perspective, this is not about selling Matt. It's really about working locally, because those people are living in our community. They're responsive to realtors. They understand what a commitment date means. They understand when to order an appraisal vis-a-vis when the inspection occurs. If you're dialing an 800 number, you're going on to a website, those people only look at you as a number that gets pushed along, and it closes whenever it closes. It's really important to be responsible and responsive in our marketplace, regardless of what position you carry. So there's tons of great loan officers in this town. I like most all of them. It's really about doing the right thing for the process, the seller, the buyer here locally.
And Jim, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm not selling Matt. I work with, disclosure, I work with Matt a lot and have for 15 years, I think. But he's one of a few local lenders that I recommend to my buyers, because I know, Matt is a member of the community. He's accountable to the clients, to me, to the realtor community, where, if he puts his name on a letter saying these people are qualified, particularly in this environment, that seller's going to be able to say, oh, well, my agent says that Matt's good. He's probably going to be able to close. And when I'm helping sellers evaluate multiple offers, the lender is one of the factors, as far as they know the people, they know the attorneys, they know the processes, they know, property tax rates, which a lot of these, the national lenders don't have that insight for some reason. They know how we close in Charlotte. I mean, they're local lenders are familiar with, the nuances of our market and how we work. I've got stories from clients, and one let me publish it because he was so upset, from a big lender that, screwed things up. They closed eventually, but it was a pain that was unnecessary. Matt's great, and we have a number of great local lenders in the Charlottesville area who, there are many evenings I've had where I'm 9:30 at night, I'm texting Matt, I'm texting the other agent, I'm texting on the phone with my clients, and Matt's there answering questions, and my clients are like, y'all really do this at 9:30 or 10 o'clock on a Friday night? I'm like, yeah, this is what we do. I don't think I would get a big unnamed lender to be texting me at 9:30 on a Friday night.
And just so the callers know, this segment of the discussion is more about, I guess, shopping local than it is about Matt in particular, which is why I asked that question, because I didn't know what the answer was going to be. Again, our guest today, as we talk about the real estate market, is Jim Duncan with Charlottesville Nest Realty, Matt Hodges with Presidential Bank Mortgage. Jim mentioned earlier, you can read some of the articles he's written. You can go to realcentralva.com and sign up to get his articles. Gentlemen, we're talking about the strong market and some of the good and bad decisions. I had read about property inspection waivers. Can you talk about that? I'm not sure who should jump in first, who has more hands in on that.
Yeah, that's clearly in my court, because it has to do with what lenders will accept if there's financing involved. Now, If it's a cash deal, you know, appraisal can be waived, inspection can be waived. But if we're talking about a transaction that has financing attached to it, there are options for both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loans, which are the two largest producers of mortgages out there. There's options with as little as 10% down to waive the appraisal. And, of course, we've got to run what's called automated underwriting in order to write a pre-qualification letter for Jim or for anyone else. And in that automated underwriting, it gives us a result of property inspection waiver is acceptable or it's not. And if it is, it can strengthen the pre-qualification letter so that the seller feels more confident about that piece. Of course, the client has to agree that they're willing to waive it because they don't have to waive it even if we have that result. But it might give an advantage to a buyer. If it's after the contract's been ratified, it's an option. It's something that the client can consider. It's a savings of, you know, $600 of the appraisal, but they don't get the validation that the sales price equaled the purchase price. And that may be where Jim can step in and say what his personal preference is in general, but not necessarily in a specific situation.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. But if I'm representing a seller, you know, I would love to get an offer that waives the inspection. It makes it, from a seller's perspective, it makes it a much cleaner offer and a much greater likelihood of going to close. From a buyer's perspective, in 20 years of doing this, I've had one buyer I was not able to talk into getting a home inspection during the previous hot market, and they actually tore the house down. I think it's, you know, regardless of the market, I think it's absurd to waive a home inspection. That said, there are some ways that I navigate this sort of thread with my clients that they can protect themselves while waiving the home inspection. But no, I think it's, you know, that not only is it an opportunity for the buyer to learn the house, it's their protection against finding some sort of significant structural defect that would absolutely affect their decision to buy the home. Got a seller. Go ahead.
Oh, just for the listener's clarification, we're talking about two different inspections. Jim's primarily focusing on the home inspection. I'm focusing on the appraisal inspection. So, and I generally agree there, the home inspection is a vital piece of the home buying process.
Yeah, so I'll go after the appraisal real quick. You know, it does depend, but I think it's something that if a buyer were to waive the appraisal contingency, they and $400,000 stuck in my head today. You know, if the offer price is $400 and it appraises for $380, the buyer is potentially on the hook for that $20,000 delta. So you've seen clauses where the buyer up front agrees to pay whatever the delta is between the purchase price and the appraised value. You know, Rick, we're in a market with extreme velocity right now. And we don't yet have the sold comps that will validate some of the prices we're seeing for the pending properties. We will in a few months. But right now we're in a position of the market where, there's such great velocity of transactions that it's making it tougher to price things that will, you know, work with the appraised values.
Our guests today, Jim Duncan and Matt Hodges, as we talk about the real estate market in our area. A phrase that Jim used earlier was the strongest seller's market in 20 years. Let's take a break. I can talk a little bit more.
In the 20 years I've been practicing.
Thanks for the... for straightening me out on that. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. And thank you so much for being with us today on another Sunday on the Wake Up Call. Our guests, Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges, as we talk about Charlottesville area real estate market. Gentlemen, if it's one of the strongest sellers markets in Jim's 20 years of being in the business, And certainly in a significant amount of time here, there are homes being sold at some of their highest rates we've seen in a while, many more buyers than sellers. I would assume bidding wars. Is there some sort of recipe for disaster that must be watched out for?
So, Rick, we see often a, I don't want to say desperation, but there's certainly an anxiousness about buyers right now and realtors as well, where a property comes in the market, it fits the needs for their client, but they know it's going to be in high demand. And so the realtors' conversations are, okay, how can we get to the front of the line? Let's do a quick closing. Let's do a cash contract. Let's waive the need for an appraisal. Let's put in an escalation clause. Let's do a quick commitment date in the contract. Those all can put stresses throughout the process. There are so many professionals that touch a transaction from start to finish that it becomes a situation where there's going to be upset feelings. There's going to be expectations that are dashed. So recently, and this is under contract right now in another city, but recently a realtor asked me for a 3-week closing, and I just said no. I'm not going to be a party to that. You can use another lender if you wish, but I know that it's not going to close within that time frame because there's an inspection period of time. There's just the simple processing and underwriting and closing of the loan. There's so many pieces that it just wasn't a fair situation to put any of the participants through because there would be expectations that were dashed. So I just said, frankly, no, this is the time frame that we need to do within. And they agreed. It was just sort of holding your ground in the bigger scheme of things when you're concerned about all of the noise around you, all the other buyers, all of the thoughts that you're putting into the seller's head or that you're trying to position yourself to think like the seller. You've got to sometimes just step back and say, no, this is what we can do. This is our highest and best scenario. And as Jim said in the previous segment, they have to be prepared to either win or lose at that price. It has to feel right. And the recipe for disaster, the other things that are included in there, can just spoil the whole process for so many people in the industry that it's just not fair to do. So we try to guard from doing everything fast, and waiving protections for our clients.
It seems like if you go searching for a home on whatever platform, software platform you choose to use, homes don't sit very long. But sometimes you see homes that have been on the market for weeks. Jim, is there something that identifies a house that has been sitting on the market for many weeks? Is it overpriced? Does it have a structural flaw that the seller won't use? I mean, what is it when homes are selling within 2 days of being on the market? Why is there something sitting there for 12 weeks, for 20 weeks, et cetera?
It depends. I think that it's hard to say that, if a property's been on the market for more than 3 weeks. And I'm looking at some houses in the city right now. I pulled the pendings in the city. New construction excluded. The median days on market is 6, which is crazy. But it goes from 0 days on the market to 913. So I think that there's, the 32 are under contract under 80 days. So what does that say about the other ones? I think it depends on each one. I think that it could be price. It could be, bad neighbors. It could be there's some damage in the basement. Or it could be just it's a unique house that's not a generic homogenous house that appeals to the broad segment of the market. That's why I'm always I try to be careful when I'm saying that the market is fantastic, because for the people out there who are sitting with their houses on the market for 3, 4, 10, 15 weeks, they're sitting there saying, why is my house not selling? It's because it might not be the right house for the market right now. So it's, ultimately, I think that, Rick might, it's almost always about price. I mean, if you put a house that, for $500,000 and it doesn't sell, and it's a $300,000 house, of course it's not going to sell. So I think that regardless of the market, price is the number one thing. Price and preparation and presentation are the three big things you need to do. But it really does depend on what the market is.
Does a realtor or Matt, would someone in your field have anything to do in terms of helping the seller recognize why a home is still sitting on the market for such an extended period of time?
I give the facts. I think that, a couple of years ago, I was in Vegas speaking at a convention, and someone said, what's the hardest thing you do? And when you're talking to a seller, and I said, telling them their house smells is one of the hardest things. And they said, well, how do you do that? I said, I tell them their house smells. If it smells like cats or dogs or smoke or whatever, it's my role as the professional to be candid and blunt and say, this is a deficiency we need to address, whether through remediating the smell or reducing the price by X to solve that problem for the buyers. From my perspective as a seller's agent, my job is to go through with an objective lens. Oftentimes I'll bring a stager and all that stuff, but helping people understand that there are things that they might love about their home, that nobody else is going to love. Even in this market, if you've got a hole in the drywall from where your kid, knocked a thing into the drywall a couple years ago, fix the hole, even though it has sentimental value. So I think it's, you have to make sure, you have to take the home from being a home into being a product on the market and look at it like that, rather than the place where you raised your two kids and your dogs.
You wrote an article I mentioned, Jim Duncan. You can go to realcentralva.com and read some of the articles and sign up for regular articles. There's one called Sniffing Basements.
Yeah, yeah. I had a client years ago. I do a lot of video for my out-of-area clients, and she remarked to how I have a habit of sniffing when I went into basements. And I said, yeah, because it's an easy way to discern whether there's mold or moisture in a basement. I mean, it's not clearly not a, I wouldn't base an inspection on my nose, but if the basement smells wet, there's a darn good chance that there's some moisture infiltration that's going to be a challenge. That's why everybody should have a dehumidifier in the basement. But you fix those things before you go to market. Sounds simple, but for a lot of people, you get nose blind in your own home, and you don't know that the house smells like wet dog because you live there all the time.
Jim Duncan with Charlottesville Nest Realty. We also have Matt Hodges here with Presidential Bank Mortgage. So, gentlemen, we've got historically low interest rates, and obviously we have. Is that playing a role in why we have so many buyers, or are there other issues going on here?
Yeah, so, Rick, you mentioned one side of it. With low interest rates begets buyers, first-time home buyers, move-up buyers. There's a desire to get into the marketplace because money is so darn cheap. We're talking about low threes or high twos. That's fantastic for homebuyers. My first interest rate was 8.25%, and my realtor remarked that it was below 10%. That's great. You know, it's all relative to the times, but because they're so low, it brings out the buyers. But likewise, interest rates are so low and the sellers have a great rate. Do they really want to sell at this point? They're building up equity. They like their house. Maybe it's just not the right time frame because it is the house that they want to live in long term, and they do have a fantastic rate. It's a bit of a double-edged sword because they're low. We have a challenge with appreciating prices as well. Because rates are low and houses have appreciated, there's affordability. But if you take one of the two out of that equation, where you have interest rates that are climbing, then you're going to have some issues with affordability if the house prices don't continue to inflate at some percentage, some reasonable number.
Can someone speak to the taxes over the next 1 or 5 or 10 years? Is there, I mean, once I buy a house at this newly appreciated rate, what's happening tax-wise over this time period? Is there going to be a flattening here? Is it going to go up? Is there thoughts on any sort of downfall or potential bust in the future just by the standard seesaw? If it goes one way, it must come down the other?
Well, I wouldn't speculate on what the future holds regarding assessments and appraised values and sales prices. But you do have appreciation and inflation that you need to concern yourselves with wherever you purchase. So in the county, it's been a little more sensitive. The tax rate's gone up at least every other year and sometimes every year. And primarily that's driven on revenues needed for school funding. The city has held their tax rate for a number of years, but they raise additional monies by increasing the assessments on property. And there is a law about equalization, meaning it can't be assessed for higher than fair market value. But that is the other route to bring in additional tax dollars, either have a higher assessment or a higher tax rate.
Well, and am I wrong to assume that after the past school year, past and current, and the difficulty of financial spending, that Albemarle County will certainly need more money in their school system and possibly Charlottesville as well?
I wouldn't speculate. As Matt said, I think that projecting out what's going to happen in the next 2 years, 5 years, 10 years is hard. I've said for years that I'll tell you what happens today in 18 months. But with the schools, I think that's, again, it's the assessed values are contingent on what the actual market value is. So right now they look like they just went up. Annual assessment in the county and the city, they went up a bit. Rates are the same as I understand right now. But, from a school's perspective, we'll see what happens with the school board budget. I think that yes, they're going to need more money, as they always do. There are a lot of capital improvement projects that are needed in the city and the county. But they tend to not raise property tax rates solely to accommodate school needs, for better or worse. So I think it really does depend on what ultimately what the politicians and the budget say with respect to what's going to happen with assessments and or what's going to happen with the tax rate going forward. So it's a hard nut to crack with respect to the school budgets, but 2022 is going to be an interesting year as we come out of the pandemic, hopefully.
Well, we talk about appreciation and assessments because of this strong real estate market. Again, Jim Duncan from Charlottesville Nest Realty and Matt Hodges with Presidential Bank Mortgage. Is the market so strong because there are so many buyers than in years past, or because there are so few sellers than years past?
Yes.
Yes.
I knew that was coming. That was going to be the answer.
So we've got a new phenomenon, Rick, and I know you're aware of this. With COVID comes portability of jobs. Buyers don't have to work for their company here in Charlottesville. It's not a prerequisite at all. What is being able to log in and have a reliable, reasonable internet connection, and two, have access to an airport. That's what it takes. And because Charlottesville is such a desirable place to live, people are flocking here because they can, because their employers said, sure, no problem. And I'm seeing it on a regular basis with big name tech companies from California that you know well. Those people are moving here because they can do so. They're moving here from New York because they can. They're moving here from Northern Virginia because they can. And guess what those three places have that we don't? They have high-cost housing. And so people coming from those three areas are used to paying higher prices. And that is exacerbating the situation here, in my opinion. Now, it's anecdotal, but I've seen it happen.
So is this trend, and I'll put quotes around it, bad? And we got to take a break soon so we can continue the conversation. But is this a bad trend?
I mean, I don't know whether that matters. Whether it's good or bad, I think it's going to happen. We'll come back up to this, but you're seeing that companies large and small are reevaluating their usage of their space, of their office space. That's going to impact not just how and where people live and work, but also society as a whole. So I think it's, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. It's going to change our society and our culture forever.
All right, let's take our next break, and we'll come back and continue talking about the real estate market with today's guests, Matt Hodges and Jim Duncan. Hang tight. And here we are again talking about the local real estate market with our guests, Jim Duncan, Matt Hodges. Gentlemen, we were talking about the influx of new citizens to our Central Virginia area coming from other areas around the United States. And Matt, you said that they needed two key things, access to the internet and a local airport. But it's been said that Albemarle County, and I know this just from my own family, my wife works for Albemarle County public school system, and the number of people in Albemarle County who do not have access to the internet. So it seems as though if you are moving to Central Virginia and trying to live in Albemarle County, are you not cutting off a percentage of your options when looking for a home? Do you need to look elsewhere as well?
I mean, from my perspective, I've got clients a couple clients who are evaluating Nelson County and even parts of Louisa because over Albemarle County, because for these folks, more of my clients now are choosing to not have kids and they have their pets, where the school system is less of a factor. And the internet availability is the critical factor. And Albemarle County has been, I'll go ahead and say negligent in their rollout of broadband and approval, what have you, where Nelson, with the partnership with CVEC, Central Virginia Electric, and Firefly, are offering fiber broadband throughout the county. And they're doing that in Louisiana, I think parts of Savannah as well. If you don't have internet, you can't work at home. And, the pandemic is forcing almost everybody to work at home. And that's a shift that's not going to change. People are realizing they can work at home and don't need massive amounts of office space. And for me, I have a survey I use with my buyers. And one of the questions is internet, do you need internet? More to alert my incoming buyers that, if they're from San Francisco or Seattle or Portland or D.C., and internet is ubiquitous there, I want to alert them that that's not the case here. And there's no great way to search by internet availability. Again, 99.8% of the time, your home is going to be not even devalued, but almost unsellable to the breadth of the market if you don't have internet access.
So, Jim, you mentioned Nelson County putting in a fiber broadband system with Firefly and and I guess it's government or the electric co-op down there. I'm curious how they make that happen, and I don't know if you know the answer. Albemarle County is a huge county. I think I looked it up, 720,000 square feet. But Nelson is 470,000 square feet, so two-thirds?
Miles.
Right, sorry, square miles. Sorry. Bad notes. But Nelson County seems to have a lot more mountainous area. How do you make that happen in one area and not in the other?
I mean, the best answer is, one, I don't care. my clients care that we have internet. The mechanics of how it gets done are irrelevant. But I think that's a question that I would say the answer is probably in large part political and economic will. Clearly, it can be done. Those folks have said this is a service we're going to offer, and they're executing it. I think that also CVEC, from my client's lens, I mean, that's a fantastic company that's part of the community. They're looking to do something that is good for the community, but is also profitable. So I think that's something that, Albemarle County, I think we have five power providers throughout the county, but the main one has not, gone on this sort of a tangent, if you will. So I think it's something that it's just a difference in the localities and the economic and political will.
Do you think that the expectation that remote work will fade away or pass in coming years and the housing market will turn in another direction?
I mean, I don't think so. I think that you're seeing commercial real estate is something that people are looking at. Big and small companies are evaluating whether they need X amount of square footage when people are perfectly happy and productive working at home. If I could guess right now, in 5 years, more people would be at work than they are today, but not the percentage or the number of people who are at work 2 years ago.
What role does virtual education play in the real estate market? I'm not strictly talking about internet access here, because that seems to be tied in tightly to working from home. But does it play a role in the decisions that the University of Virginia might make, or has made, if you live near the university or you own rental properties in that UVA students might have used in past years, but now the university is going more virtual, might you be selling those instead? Or because that sort of pathway in my thinking?
I hope they sell. We need more inventory.
Functional obsolescence, though, in those homes.
Yeah. What was that, Matt?
I wouldn't be surprised.
There's a lot of functional obsolescence in those homes, those group homes, if you will, that are chopped up and have locks on doors and separate eating areas and multiple kitchens. It can be a challenge to retrofit it into a single-family residence to sell later on.
Got it.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, Rick, it's way too early to guess what's going to happen with higher education. I think that there's a lot of arguments out there that says, if you can get, an education that is just, from a less expensive university as you can from an expensive university virtually, why would you spend, $80,000 a year to go to a certain university? I think that's a whole another conversation as far as the impact of pandemic on higher education, real estate, all that stuff. I think that one thing that we've seen with the pandemic right now is, and it's hard to answer, but right now we're seeing, we used to see a seasonality in the market in Charlottesville where January and February would be ramp up time for market and inventory. It would taper off in June, July, typically. Right now, we have so many dynamics that have shifted from the loss of the market in 2020 to the lack of a school year, if you will, that the seasonality has been flattened to a large degree.
Has the rental market been affected in any way?
I mean, what I'm seeing, more people are paying higher prices for rent. Again, it's supply and demand. More people want to be in the Charlottesville area than we have housing for. We have and it's not just in Charlottesville, we have a housing crisis in our country where prices are going way higher than people can afford across the broad spectrum of the market. I mean, the mid to upper echelon is, for lack of a better term, fine. But broadly, prices are crazy high for a lot of my clients, and it's a difficult and challenging market for many.
I'm curious. We've sort of skimmed around and over how the COVID pandemic has played a role or affected some bits and pieces here, but I'm curious how a borrower might be affected and how a realtor would even show a house. I mean, you see things virtually, but I'm curious as to how that might affect things. But Matt, let's start with you on how someone who's self-employed specifically might be affected during these times of making a home purchase.
Yeah, it's a great point because we dealt with it starting in about April and all the way through today, and we're still dealing with it. Self-employed borrowers typically have been treated differently than salaried W-2 employees in that we need to see 1040s, we need to see business returns if they've got a separate return. Okay, no big deal. We need to prove that they can afford the house. But it's ramped up. Both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have required now that we look at P&L statements all the way through since the last time they filed. So for many home buyer or many self-employed borrowers, they last filed in April of 2020 or even as late as July of 2020 for the year 2019, which means that right now I need a profit and loss statement, a P&L, for all of the year 2020 and all of January. And since they're not going to be closing until April, I need it for January, February, and March. So I need 15 months of profit and loss statements from this client. And I need to see 3 months of bank statements to show that there's been revenues coming in. And then we have to do these crazy math calculations to see if the revenue has stabilized since COVID hit, to see not necessarily that the profit is there as much, but to see that the dollars are coming back into the business. And, you know, you question how far this goes, because in my estimation, the small businesses, especially here locally, are huge drivers of employment. There's so many companies that fit that under 500 person business that it seems like we're overburdening them with requirements.
Is there anything to do about it, or is it just the rule that must be followed until something changes?
That is exactly correct. It is the rule that we must follow. We don't have a choice. We've got to make it tougher on self-employed borrowers because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said so. With salary employees, we can see a little bit more clearly, I guess. So UVA had a furlough for a month during 2020. It was a one-time occurrence. We got assurances from UVA that it was over, and that's all it was. We could still use somebody's full salary. But because self-employed seemed to have been hit a little bit harder, their revenues and their profits were a little bit more in jeopardy, we had to do additional tests on their income.
And Jim, does this come into effect when you show a home to someone? I mean, how nosy does the realtor get into someone's income, what their job is?
When I started many years ago, I would do the pre-qualification. I would qualify them. I have a mortgage calculator, all that stuff. But now it's just, you know, I send them to a local lender who says they're good. I mean, there are so many things that they have to provide to the lender and to the underwriter and the processor and all that stuff. That's not my world. My world for my clients is saying these people are really good at what they do and they will take care of you, and they will tell us all if you're qualified to have this conversation. We start the process really early in our home search process. But you know, I don't have a need to, or frankly desire to know, you know, frankly what their income is, where the debt to income ratio is, et cetera. I just need to know, does the lender say they're qualified, and do I trust the lender?
Yeah, and Rick, from our perspective, if they're self-employed, I'm collecting their tax return, I'm analyzing it. I'm not trusting what they say because I'm not going to write a pre-qual letter that I can't back up.
Right.
We have about a minute and a half left, gentlemen. I'm curious, it's wintertime. It doesn't really make a difference whether it's winter or summer. One of the things I enjoy most about the house I live in is we have solar panels and solar backup. What are your thoughts on that in our community?
I mean, I think it's great. I think as many people should do solar as possible. I think we're starting to see it is being reflected in property values. I think the one key thing is to know whether you're a buyer or seller, to know if the system is leased or purchased. I've heard of people going to closing and the seller didn't realize they still owed $15,000 on that their solar package. They have to pay off at closing. That's created some hiccups, if you will. But no, but I think it's, you know, if you can do it, why wouldn't you do solar? It's just it's a no-brainer.
And I'm not talking about it in the sense of help save the environment. I'm talking about it in the sense of our power goes out and the solar backup kicks on.
I said many, many years ago that people are not going to, again, broad brush, people are not going to go green unless they're saving green. You know, I think it's, if you can save money by doing solar and being off the grid as much as possible, you know, go for it. ROI is, you know, it's not, you know, not one-to-one immediately, but if you're going to be there for you know, X number of years, and the client should do the math with the solar company, it makes a ton of sense to you know, not just save money through the power output, but also save, you know, help to save the environment.
All right, gentlemen, again, our guest today, Matt Hodges. He's the Charlottesville branch manager at Presidential Bank Mortgage. And Jim Duncan, he's a broker partner at the Charlottesville Nest Realty. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Rick. Have a good morning.
You know, we'll have you back in a few months because the market will change once again. Next week, we'll be talking about grief for yourself, your family, or your friends. Certainly things everyone needs to know. Take care, everyone.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.